three of them photographed themselves with little straight pins at eye level for her, and she was about 5'1". We did things which, and the people who, A Space Gallery at that point was run by a group of artists. I think there were several women involved, but not none of the rest of whom were exhibiting, other than this is the first time I had exhibited. There wasn't a tremendous amount of support or lack of support. There was simply not acknowledgement that this particular show went on. I am going to show you now photographs. I did all these photographs of people with fruits and vegetables, believe it or not. So here we go, a few of them. They're incredibly naive. And I think what I was trying to do was I was trying to insist on an equality within sexuality. And I frequently, almost everything was done in series and was photographed, the male and the female were photographed equally with the same fruits and vegetables doing the same kinds of things. None of which are explicit. We're talking, you know, real, beyond Bambi here. There's a certain amount of correspondence that I was trying to get at with this photograph. And I think that I hadn't heard yet that you weren't supposed to take pictures of men without erections. And, you know, so, and this the person who I photographed obviously hadn't heard it either, so he let me, and then he let me exhibit it, and everybody who in the gallery came in, and they hadn't heard either, and they, you know, thought that this photograph was humorous. There, within the critique of the pornographic image, that is partly what has been said, and I think it is true, that we're not used to seeing, you know, that the only photographs that we can see, or a lot of the photographs that we see of men are in these positions of overt power, and certainly the erect phallus, as the location of power is part of that. I didn't think about that when I took this photograph, but I think I was internalizing some of the, I was reading a tremendous amount of feminism. There was not a lot of feminist critique of particular images of that women were producing at this time. This was taken in 1972. Okay, so that's that one. That was part of a series. Now this is part of another series which had about 5 photographs in it. This is the female part of it. And I was dealing with symmetry a lot. So this would be photographed. And again, the unerect phallus. The big no-no. I think that primarily people, you know, and most of the photographs in these series were like this. They were sort of humorous. They were quite gentle. They were not explicit sexually. They all involved nudity in one way or another. And no one thought anything one way or the other about them. I think women really liked the photographs in general. And I didn't find any opposition or anyone was telling me I was doing anything bad. So I can't say that I was sort of picked upon because I used kind of referred to sexuality in with these images. I moved into another style of work. I just realized all these slides are backwards. So that's going to be a problem soon. I think in terms of the imagery that you were just, with the strawberries, and I was talking about, you know, doing one photograph with a male body, one photograph with a female body, that there was a certain attempt, I was also trying to deny the power of either male sexuality or female sexuality as an entity in and of itself, because it was very much opposed at that point to essentialist feminism and to biological determinism around things, but had an overwhelming urge to photograph, you know, sexual things and vegetables and growing things, and it got worse. It got much worse. I went way deeply into it, denying all the time that this had any kind of basis in femininity, completely denying it, overtly denying it. Denying it had a lot of things, and I'll just start talking about denial in a minute. That's what I was doing, and I think I was trying to deny the power of certain things by presenting things in absolute symmetry. You know, you're not going to misread this image, by God, because I'm going to give you, you know, bookends here, and I'm going to, you know, you can't have it the way you want it. That image that you just saw was one. Actually, I should go back to it maybe. Oh, I can't do that. What's happening? Are you fooling? Were you twisting those? I was just going to go back to this one. Can I go backwards? Maybe I can. I was just going to show. I don't need to show that other image. I started to work, rather than as literally as I had before, I started to work with more ritual kind of imagery. Again, denying any kind of, in spite of the fact I was reading a lot at that point about goddess imagery, etc., because I denied it so effectively, I can't honestly claim to have been doing it, because I didn't think I was, and I didn't think I was interested. It's that position now strikes me as being incredibly naive. But there was a reason why I was denying that also. And it had to do with the fact that I was, the photography co-op I was working within had dissolved after about 6 months, and I had no support system in the women's art community in Toronto. And I felt that the worst thing possible that I could do, and I know this and I have it in sort of journal form, I felt the worst thing possible I could do would be to be identified as a woman doing female imagery. So I continued to do female imagery, I just said I wasn't. So that, you know, I don't know if it did me any good. But I mean, I can't say that I'm proud of this particular type of denial, or I think this is like really cute, because it wasn't. I mean, I think there were reasons. And I think it leads me now to understand, I think I teach to understand my women students who sometimes go through tremendous denial over just terminology. That's not a feminist work, no. That doesn't deal with women's issues, these are universal. And those and when I hear that, I hear myself, you know, in 1973. So, okay, I want to read a quote from Lucy Lippert, this is written in 76, it's from an unpublished essay, or this book was out in 76, I think. Yeah, and this essay has never been published. So, she says, quote, "Artistic motivation and imagery have rarely been studied by people who understand the aesthetic and art historical sources as well as the psychological ones. And on the other hand, much has been written in recent years about the perception of contemporary art from the retinal and philosophical points of view and from that of Gestalt psychology. But a most significant element in seeing art has been neglected. How a viewer innocent of, quote, art appreciation, unquote, looks at art, and the influence of the individual's experience, fantasies, and associations as they merge, or not, with those of the artist. Because women's erotic experience is not the same as men's, and because a great deal less is known about it than about male sexuality in art, this area of identification may be harder to perceive. Because of the dangers of exposure, sexual imagery in women's art has been externalized so unconsciously that it remains personally threatening for many artists to confront their own content." I didn't actually read that until sometime within the last week when I was looking for a quote for something. I don't recall reading that before. I read the book, but it didn't strike me. So I think in that sense, I probably wasn't alone in terms of denying certain aspects. I think I more denied the specific female nature to some of the imagery I was exploring rather than the sexuality, but I think there were similar kinds of denial. Okay. These are now going backwards. What am I going to do? This thing's falling apart. What do we think? Okay, I see. All right. This is when I was talking about ritual, I started to deal with plants a lot more, natural cycles, and those kinds of things, and transparency, which is quite evident there. Okay, and I started to address issues of reproduction. But when I say address issues of reproduction, this is how I addressed it. I took a picture of it, so big deal. Okay, not much action there. Okay, all right, so I've got to hurry now. There's a certain thing that happened in terms of the denial of the symbolic, which I went through. Because it was determined by the then current art criticism crew, most of whom were men, I decided that I would deny a symbolic interpretation of my work. And I then proceeded to do a series of photographs which were exhibited in 1974 in A Space, and it was my own show at that point, that were you know, absolute they involved every symbol that anybody's ever seen. There were configurations of animals and plants put in circles, and I'll show you, I can show you some of those. There were things, you know, I mean, it was wild. It went on. Whoops, sorry. All right. So these were milkweed pods. This is one series of things, and then these come onto a female body, onto a male body. Okay. I can't do it, or else I can't get through it. Okay, I'm sorry, because I took too much time. All right, now the announcement, this particular show, of which these photographs are a part, and there were 53 photographs, they were all taken in natural light, and I constructed big, enormous things to display them under skylight so that there were no lights on in the gallery. The piece is called Divination by Dream, and I sent out an announcement to announce this to people to come to see it. I said, there's nothing symbolic about these photographs. These are real objects. So, and then I gave a list of all of them, including their, you know, Latin names. So, there was lots of symmetry in this too. And again, but I'll show you one photograph which is particularly telling if you think there's nothing symbolic going on. And a male critic interviewed me about this show, and he became so anxious at my denial that he swallowed a peach pit in my kitchen. And just went hairy, which I can't blame him, because it was, you know, but I stood my ground. There was nothing symbolic in this. No. So, and there was the reason for doing this was that I felt I would get trapped in the symbolism. I thought I would get trapped in some kind of essentialist female thing, and being a female meant lacking in power. And I know that, and I knew it, and I think that the two people who have spoken before me on this panel know it from different perspectives, but we all know it. So, I wanted to make a very brief note on self-determination that I had, I was given authorization and took and grabbed authorization to make these rather outrageous statements and, you know, sort of stupid statements, but that people had to pay attention to because of my position of working within a gallery where I had a certain amount of self-determination. I could say, I want a show, and demand that they give me a show, and I could do it any way I wanted to. And I fully recognize that many, many artists working never had that opportunity to have put up and done exactly what they wanted. And I urge you to do it, and to take control of institutions right now, tomorrow. You know, get down to the Vancouver Art Gallery and get those people off the board and make it, you know, the new women's art center of the city. So, right on. And, you know, barring that, set up some other things, some storefront galleries, Women in Focus. There are a number of places. You must show your work as you want it shown, because you can't. There's too much fear, and, you know, and that's what I'm trying to get at here. Anyway, okay. I started to make videotapes now at this point, and there's a poster here. Okay, yeah, this is, now, of course, the writing is backwards because the slide is. This is a poster I was talking about in the performance. It says, videotapes to lay to rest a myth, and it's signed there, yours, the lady killer. Now, that has absolutely nothing to do. I circulated. I had it printed at a quick print shop across the street from my house, and I circulated it through the mail. I put it up on posters and all this other kind of stuff for a video show. And I showed a piece there called Internal Pornography, which was completely unexplicit. It was a three-monitor piece on one monitor I related dreams, on the other it was a nude torso sketching reproductive parts and reading from a drugstore sex manual. And in the middle was a sort of hypnotic hand movement. Again, there was nothing symbolic about any of this. Don't want anybody to get the wrong idea. One statement that I made was completely rubbed half the audience, the male half of the audience, wrong. And and I had a lot of real deep discussions, not hostility, but very painful discussions with people, because in that tape, Internal Pornography, I said, if you really knew what went on inside me, you wouldn't want to know me. I think I thought that at that point. I'm not going to show you actually almost any other things. I have some slides from videotapes which are really inadequate, and I don't have many more of the other kinds of slides. What happened was gradually I think that the imagery that I began to use became more defined along the axis of wanting to specifically explore sexuality. Frequently within, I actually did a tape called The Damages, and I was interested in Catherine's piece, The Damage, which involved scars. I've done a number of tapes around scars on my body and just what happens in general. When I was speaking polemically in this paper, I was speaking that I didn't want to be presented as a damaged, you know, and as a damaged female sexuality, that's what I was objecting to. And one of the first steps that I had to make was to acknowledge that I was actually presenting my sexuality and to take responsibility for accepting that damage and share it. And then I think I was able to go on with some more perhaps political kinds of projects, which include, I'm going to say, I don't think the video still, that's from Birthday Suit with Scars and Defects, which I did on my birthday. This is from a tape called Facing South, which had a thing about looking closely with magnifying glasses and was hideously obsessive, and I ate all my plants. And I took a magnifying glass at one point and said, here, looking here closely is hard or something. Even under magnification, the clitoris remains hidden between two folds of skin. So I was sort of getting closer to the source here somehow. This is from the book, which is circulating. I just want to speak very briefly. I only have two more minutes, I'm sure, one more. I did this book for the opening show of the Art Gallery of Ontario when they opened their new wing, and it was called something. I can't remember what the show was called. There were about 25 younger artists. This is in 1974, from Toronto, who were asked to put pieces of work in this. I did this book, which is going by, which was sat on a little table. It was large photographs that were sort of like this, with this very obsessive text, which said there is, and it was titled, "There's Nothing Natural About This, These Are Photographs." So again, we have some kind of denial of natural process that was going on. But I felt, and I still do feel, it was important to take an analytical. There's a grid on the photographs, and people can look at that thing today. There are pins up. I performed other kinds of ritual activities, including this one. The most important thing about this piece was that I think it did address some of the things that I was interested in. It brought a kind of female content into the Art Gallery of Ontario, where it was very foreign in that sense. It was a brand new building being inaugurated, the Henry Moore wing that week. And I was glad of the way that I did it, and that is that I didn't frame this work. I didn't do anything like that. I put it on a table, and the piece that you're seeing, it was meant to be handled, and it's dirty now. And it's never been shown again, but it's dirty on the corners. That what happened was people turned the pages and their hands got on it. Someone said to me at that time, "Doesn't that make you feel, because it's your image, doesn't it make you feel like you're in a pornographic magazine?" And I said, "No, it doesn't make me, because I took the pictures." And I didn't know what that meant. But I think it's also about something about self-determination. It didn't make me feel bad at all. It made me feel nothing. I liked the fact that people were handling my art rather than looking at it under a frame. And that was just my sort of personal yet another obsession. So that's from that piece. And this is from a videotape called Waiting for Lancelot. And that's called I'm Having Trouble with My Heart. And that's from a book illustration, again, The Recurrent Gun, whatever that means. Nothing symbolic there. This is from a videotape called The Damages, which, and it's hard to photograph in this. This is a piece of the shot starts at the face and goes down, and this person is clothed and they're reading, and it goes below the table and they're nude. And this is The Damages being revealed. A bandage is taken off a scar. That same tape. This is from La Gloria Tapes, which is overtly has nothing to do with sexuality, but deals with sort of a woman's problems. She has, her tubes are all like tied around each other, and she has to have an operation, and she can't figure out what to do about it. And so she relates some of this stuff, and I put a visual pun in here for me. This is a very hardcore pornographic magazine, and she's pointing to her boyfriend where her problem is on that. And that was important for me to put that in. I not because I was admitting it, because this is a woman who sought information from a number of different sources, some of which were authorized and some of which were not. This is a videotape called, some call it Bad Luck. And there's nothing sexual in it at all, except there's tremendous sexual oppression of this woman because of innuendo. And it's a police interrogation thing. And I don't know why I put that slide in. Which brings us to the piece which Joan Borsa showed yesterday. And so you've seen this. I would like to read it, though. It is not a question of arousal as it is of power. We are talking about the visual depiction of sexuality. We look forward to a time when sex is in the picture because sex is the subject. We resent advertising's relentless mobilization of human sexuality, which objectifies people while sexualizing objects. It goes on like that. And as she pointed out yesterday, it's a mock ad. And it refers to itself as a mock ad. It says what it is in this magazine. And it's an art magazine. So. And this is an art piece, but this is sometimes we don't need it when we're obviously having oral sex, and sometimes we do, so there. Yeah. And we go on with saying why it was we did this, and one thing which said, we're presenting images of explicit heterosex with specific references to birth control. We challenge the compartmentalization of the issues involved. Birth control is a health issue or a women's issue, romantic involvement, excuse me, with sexual overtones, but no explicit depiction. As the province of the mass media, an explicit depiction of sexual acts confined to the parameters of porn. We want to indicate pleasure through sex in these pictures. So that was the piece that is in the magazine. And I think we've had some discussions that I'm stopping, don't believe me, I am, I know. In this conference about context and where stuff is being presented. And I think that many people are making attempts to do different kind of work. That was when we put that piece into Insight. We were working with an editorial collective of 8 other people. And we got the agreement and approval of the group. And even though everybody was a little bit uncomfortable with some of the work or whatever, we decided as a collective we would go forward with it. And it seemed appropriate that there was some discussion of sexual imagery with sexual imagery being present. So that was all we wanted to do. Our distributor, our Canadian distributor, pulped the magazine before distributing it, supposedly due to a, what do they call it, a bureaucratic kind of, you know, problem. Some instructions had gotten crossed. But that magazine never, for the most part, except for the magazines that we distributed, and we never had the money to reprint it, never was circulated. So that's literally the only copy I have left. And that was our own magazine that we printed. So when we talk about, and of course, you know, with these people, there was no question of censorship. It was just some little problem that had arisen, and somehow they'd ended up in a shredder. But, you know, I think we have a long way to go, but I think that even when we have our own institutions, we're not safe, is what all I was trying to say, but that's a start. So I'm finished now. I went way over, sorry. Sorry, I took extra time. I didn't realize this. I had rehearsed it.
Can you hear me now? Okay. Thank you, Lisa. The next speaker on our panel is Cindy Patton, who's a writer and activist from Boston and one of the co-editors of the magazine called Bad Attitude, which has been held at the border and not allowed into Canada.
I want to talk a little bit about the magazine, but mostly I want to read from it. It was not my ambition as a child to be banned in British Columbia. It was also not my ambition as a feminist writer for 8 years to be censored from feminist bookstores. How did this happen? I asked myself. It began about 3 or 4 years ago when I wrote some basically very academic pieces of art and film criticism which viewed erotica and pornography as cultural artifacts enmeshed in a matrix of social, political, and personal practices. We've been hearing all about this all weekend. I thought it was fairly straightforward academic stuff. Never in my wildest dreams did I imagine the wrath that would come down upon me. I was quickly identified as being in favor of pornography. But in discussing with people what they meant by this, I rapidly discovered that everyone had something totally different in mind when they said pornography, if they had anything in mind at all. Concurrently with my personal problems getting published in a few feminist magazines, a number of my lesbian, feminist, and gay liberationist friends began to confess to me a yearning for what Chris Birchall at the Body Politic has called a smut of our own. And so Bad Attitude was born in this political and grassroots context. Bad Attitude is not for profit, and indeed we barely cover our costs. We're all volunteer, which basically means that my lover Amy Hoffman and myself put the thing together with whoever we can corral into doing things whenever we manage to get it together. We've tried to publish quarterly, but we've actually only gotten 3 issues out per year. The issue for this fall is going to be very late because many of the people that normally help us with volunteer work were too busy because they were fighting the Dworkin-McKinnon anti-porn ordinance, which was proposed in my hometown of Cambridge, much to my dismay. So far, all the people who've written or submitted photos for Bad Attitude have given us stuff that's been lying around, or stuff that they'd thought about doing but never had any place to publish it. And I think that's very significant. We've resisted the idea of trying to do some kind of market survey and figure out what lesbians want to read. And we've really steered away from directing writers and photographers toward producing something for some audience which we've projected. In other words, Bad Attitude's very much a homegrown and personal kind of periodical. And when I read pieces, I really want to, I'm going to read pieces that read well. They're not totally representative of what's in the magazine, but I'm going to tell you a little bit of the other stuff that's in there and try to show you some pictures, although you won't all be able to see them. Because I want you to get the idea of this magazine as a community project. I want to just briefly discuss some of the problems we've had. The first issue was actually published for us by some gay male friends who have published a magazine called Fag Rag for 13 years. And they've had a lot of problems getting printed. But this particular issue, which came out in tabloid form, we almost didn't get printed at all. We went all over the East Coast looking for publishers. And what they said was all the gay male stuff, and it didn't bother them. But this picture here, which is an asshole shot of a woman by her lover, was what everyone objected to. They just couldn't deal with this. In the end, we got a shop to job it out, we don't really know where, and the whole thing came back. We had to pay for it before we could get it. And the lesbian portion was upside down and backwards, which I thought perhaps was not surprising since most people don't understand lesbian sexuality. There's another picture in there of a woman's breast, which is pierced, and there's a very sharp stiletto knife in between the nipple and the ring. This was the particular picture that seemed to upset the feminist bookstores the most. And we were pretty much immediately censored from the women's bookstore in Western Massachusetts, and we thought we were censored from the Toronto women's bookstore. We were subsequently written a letter by them saying that in fact we weren't censored, but they're still not carrying it, so I'm not exactly sure what that means. The second issue basically we had no trouble with. We printed 600 copies and it sold out in 3 weeks. The main problem with that issue is that you can't get a hold of it. The third issue we again had printing problems. We went to a smaller magazine size format and we caught up. We got estimates all about a bunch of different places, and every time we would take the thing in and lay it out in front of millions of Harvard and MIT students who were getting their term papers copied, suddenly some manager would come out and swoop the whole thing up and say, I'm sorry, we can't print this. And we said, why? And usually they wouldn't give us a reason, but one place said, we have young people working on the presses here. And we do have child labor laws in the U.S. I can only imagine that he meant 18 or 19-year-olds. The third issue was also the one that didn't make its way to Little Sisters Bookstore here in Vancouver. And the circumstances of this are also unclear. They never told us why they seized it, and now they say that it's not actually been seized, or it's not actually been banned yet, but they're still in the process of deciding whether to ban it or not. And I've been told by some Canadians here that that's not an unusual situation. My guess is that there's also an asshole shot in that issue. My guess is that that's what prompted it to be seized. What I'd like to do now is just read some. I'm going to read three pieces and also give you a little description of some of the stuff that's in the magazines. And I'm going to stand. One of the things that I felt about publishing the magazine is I wanted people to know who I was and what I looked like. So many of the issues of Bad Attitude have funny little pictures of myself. And you can't, I don't think very many of you are going to be able to see this, but this is a picture of me in punk drag. I'm wearing a little feather boa and black sunglasses. And it's entitled, Editrix Patton Relaxes at Home. The first story I want to read is written by Joan Nesslin. I think a lot of you may have seen the videotape that Amber did last night where Joan talks a lot about her life in Greenwich Village in the 50s. And this story is about Butch and Femme, but I want you not to be distracted by the idea that it's about Butch and Femme if that pushes your buttons, but rather what I want you to hear in this piece is the way she articulates the history of her own sexuality in her community and how that's evolved for her over time. And the story is called The Change of Life. After 40, Femmes turn butch, we repeated laughingly, as young women in the bars. But the transformation seemed so far away, and we stood so hot in our pants that this prediction was emptied of its cultural wisdom. Now I'm in my mid-40s, and for the first time, I hold in my arms a woman who delights in her femininity, whose perfume I seek out, whose lipstick-lined lips make me melt for her, whose full body I want to hold with hands that are strong enough to grip through the flesh without leaving it behind. I know her fears. They've been mine. I know her hungers. They've been mine.